Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be in with you tonight for another typical Saturday night bumpy ride through space. And yep, Gold Lion, gonna tell you how it is. Seems like I saw a few gold lions there amongst the other Egyptian artifacts. And what's all this about Akhenaten and Tutankhamun and the elongated skulls and the Anunnaki and Nibiru? And I want to know how to pronounce that word. One night on the program, we got Nibiru, and I still can't get it out of my mouth. It still comes out sideways. All right. On the Coast to Coast AM website, which you should always pay a visit to, coasttocoastam.com, this is pretty amazing. You know, first there was this dark spot on top of the sun, right? Now there is a video of a canyon of fire. A canyon of fire. And it appears to be, of course, I'm judging from the photograph or depiction. It's a photograph. This canyon of fire is running down through this dark spot. But anyway, now we got Ison headed our way, the old sun grazer, combined with these UFO guys that run around up there, and they call them sun divers. These craft appear to just go right into the sun and then come bursting out the other side. And these things are big, too. So I'm not up there. I haven't seen one in person. It's that Missouri syndrome. It's like, okay, show me. It's like, well, you can be shown. These things are happening. Don't you find the awakening underway? And one more time, I'll ask the question, how do you like it? We'll be right back with with our guest tonight for the whole show, because we've got lots and lots to talk about. Gerald Clark, his book is The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators and Slavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. Oh, yeah. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Gerald Clark, you know, as long as we're talking about, oh, the games DARPA play now, every night and every day now, does HAARP tie into any of this? We had a guy come on the program one night. He was a caller, and he said that he was a technician, worked up there. And it's like, no, it's a communication device. It's like, yeah, okay. Thanks, pal. Do we see any way that any of these technological monstrosities might be activated by the HAARP apparatus, or is that just comic book stuff?
Hi, John. Are we on?
Yeah, we are.
Hey, buddy.
It just keeps going, doesn't it?
Yeah, let's talk about HAARP. yep. It's a very interesting platform they put together in Fairbanks, Alaska. And what they've done is basically put a grid pattern of antennas up that can then be focused on a point in the ionosphere. So it's kind of like a focal beam array.
Yep.
There's a couple things they can do with this thing, and they call it the High Amplitude Acousto-Oral Research Program. But it's very curious that the thing is also, there's a patent on it, by the way, and you can go read the patent on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And one of the uses uses it in the extreme low frequency, which is coincident with the human brain wave, which is the scary part of it. And there's a couple of things that you can do with HAARP. With that kind of energy, you can bounce it off the ionosphere and use it as an over-the-horizon backscatter radar. So you could snoop on another country significantly using it as a radar, which is against international law, according to what I've read.
So why worry about it now, right?
Yeah. Well, imagine that you could, depending on the focal point that you put on the ionosphere to get it to bounce, you could essentially adjust how big of a beam or a cone that projects onto the area that you're looking at. It could be, I don't know, the size of a city block all the way up to, you know, a whole country, just depending on how much energy you want to put into it and distribute it across that cone. Are you with me? So yeah. If you've got enough energy in there that could be higher in amplitude than the human brainwave signal in the ELF, you could essentially, in mass, control an entire country with putting thoughts in their head, if that's what you wanted to do.
Or you could turn
the power up a little bit higher, like what they've demonstrated with these Raytheon devices that they're flying along with aircraft. They were doing this in Iraq. These devices were essentially a low-level microwave that, remember we talked about you being mostly water. Well, water boils when it's exposed to 2.4 gigahertz in a microwave, so they're flying with these devices over these cities and turning them up just enough to cause your skin to start getting hot. And everybody would flee the buildings, and then they would separate the bad guys from the good guys once they got them out running like rats. Well, this is what we're doing to people. This is frightening.
This is what we're doing to people?
Yeah, well, yeah, other human beings, yeah.
In the name of all right, let me ask you this. What What about these chemtrails and these metallic particles? I suppose if you breathed in enough nanoparticulate matter comprised mostly of metals, that would aid in the heating process, yes?
It could. Well, there's a couple of theories about what's going on with the chemtrails. Are they spraying barium sulfite and various metals in there, in the atmosphere?
Yes.
Yes, they are. Now, some people believe that using HARP to electrify these ions that have been put in the atmosphere, that they get some other different effect. I'm not quite sure what it is, and I have a theory about this. Imagine HARP was being used to stimulate a sphere all around the Earth in order to keep intercontinental ballistic missiles from finding their way back in, for instance. Imagine you were able to make it strong enough where you could cause things to explode when they reentered. Well, apparently with HARP you can do that. And this is in there's a guy who wrote a book on HARP, and I have it in reference in the back of my book. And he talks about this in particular, and there's frightening things that can be done with electricity and magnetism and the electromagnetic spectrum as it relates to matter, good or bad.
So, you know, this is really something else. This is really off the charts. I mean, I was inclined.
It gets worse, actually.
Go ahead. Might as well let it rip, man.
Well, you know, if you really look at a human and how we're designed, we've got a conductor right down our middle. It's full of cerebral spinal fluid that carries electrical signals from our brain out to our extremities.
Yes.
So it gets down the electrical conductor of our spine. It reaches various nodes where the nerve tissue spreads out, where it innervates out into other tissue to control it. Well, the yogic tradition calls them chakras. You're an electrical being. Let's just face it.
Yeah.
And somehow in our design, imagine that our creators were very clever, and they designed us to interact with the electromagnetic spectrum to various effects. Imagine that was the case, and that if you were receiving certain frequencies in the ELF or other parts of your brain that might be sensitive to the electromagnetic spectrum, that they could light you up for good or for bad. So the idea of the human body as an antenna, as a receiver, is quite significant. But when you go to the article we were describing from DARPA and realizing that brainwaves are an electrical signal, well, whatever you sense, it gets turned into an electrical signal in your brain. This can be measured on an EEG. Well, let me tell you, as an electrical engineer, as soon as something is an electrical signal, you're talking about a signal that's permeating the entire universe and can be sensed with the right technology from any location, including from a satellite with the right amplification. So let me posit something for you. Imagine you're not just an antenna, that you're a transmitter too. Because like I just described to you, if I was close enough with a receiver that could measure your brain wave, they can put a little sensor on your skin and measure it, but imagine you have technology where you can sense it from a long range away. Now, all of a sudden, I could potentially not only use the telemetry to read your brainwaves, but I could probably decode the thoughts that you're modulating on there, too, so I know what you're thinking. Now, with that, another technology amplifier to that, and now let's put it up on a satellite. So now we can look at everybody and potentially read their thoughts just based on their genetic code, if we can affiliate where they're located with the signals or where they're coming from, just like any transmitter. Really helps a lot if you have a cell phone with a 911 chip in it so that they can determine where you are. So once you correlate those two, we're all transmitters. We're modems.
Mm-hmm. We're little wireless modems.
You tell me we're not being monitored. Now, here's the even funnier part. I didn't think we were going to get to this early, but I'll lay it out there for you. So in my book, I talked about the chakras, your electrical conduits, starting at the bottom with your ganglion of Impar chakra, or nerve complex on the bottom of your tailbone, all the way up to the one at the top. And in structural integration, we refer to it as the sphenopalatine ganglia. It's back behind your nasal concha, inside your nose. So that's the more positive pole of your energy body. Now imagine that this is really true, and I know it is because I've been using technology to images for years, that you could actually see where somebody's energy state is, not just their brain waves, what they're thinking, but you know, how are their chakras doing? You know, how are they animating the energy that animates all matter? Are they waking up? Are they still in their root chakra, hanging out in bars? You know, where are they at in their evolution of consciousness? And imagine you could see this from space with a satellite as little colored dots, each one of us, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. It just so happens that the wavelength of the chakras are correlated with the colors of the rainbow. Is that a surprise?
Not at this point.
I was shocked by that because I had a what's called a resonant field imaging meter that I used to go and measure the chakras with this little handheld meter with a high gain antenna on it. And if you know that the speed of light equals the wavelength times the frequency, you can go anywhere along the electromagnetic spectrum and pick a wavelength, use that little scalar, the speed of light, and you get the frequency, or vice versa. Well, wavelength is color, so you measure it, convert it to the color, you measure the frequency, convert it to a wavelength, which is color. And all of a sudden, you see in these plot-outs, printouts on a computer, that the chakras truly are the colors that the yogic tradition said they were. At various stages, and so I find that very, very interesting. So the extent to which we're being affected by the electromagnetic spectrum, now all of a sudden realizing that how much of an electrical being we are, this is really the hidden anathema to major, major problems for people that are dabbling in this area. So.
Well, this is extraordinary. I mean, I'm a little apprehensive. We may be causing widespread incontinence at this point.
A lot of people that read my book describe it as a kick, it's like being kicked in the head, and I don't know. I like that analogy. I didn't get to talk about some of the significant influences that shaped my research that led me to the Anunnaki. We're touching on a lot of the electrical things which I did actually discuss in the book, and I'd love to talk about them. Lots more, including the Starfire Gold that the Anunnaki were using.
Well, let's do that because I think you're reading my mind. Do you have me on a scope there? Because I was going to pull us in.
Actually, one of the really sought-after areas that I apparently discussed and didn't write enough about in my book was how these chakras relate to the caduceus that was carried by Thoth Hermes. And so he and his Emerald Tablets goes into infinite detail talking about energy and matter relative to humans. It's one of the most interesting reads I've ever saw. And it's one of those things where you read it once and you realize you need to read that 100 times to really...
And what is this work?
That's the Emerald Tablets of Thoth. It's a really, really profound read. And then, you know, so the idea that that we are designed as electrical beings is really amazing. And it turns out, Thoth himself, and I don't want to get too far with name Sue, but he was involved in our creation account, and I think we're going to touch on that a little bit here as well. So Thoth, his another name for him was Ningxeda, and he was Enki's second son. So,
and who are these? And who are these people?
Well, let's back up then. So the Anunnaki, who are they? According to what we know, and this is mostly from Sumerian tablets that are written in cuneiform. And they come from a planet called Nibiru or Nibiru. And there's two different ways to pronounce it for you. But so the Sumerians in these tablets that we found in along Mesopotamia, especially in Nineveh and Sippar and elsewhere, describe these beings that they said not only created them but gave them all the technology that they had in the culture of Sumer. So in that account, they describe having come here 450,000 years ago. They were having problems with their atmosphere, apparently, and when they would come close to the sun from their far orbit to perihelion, their atmosphere is getting clobbered by radiation from our sun. And it's funny, you were just talking about some crazy canyon of fire on the sun. I'm going to have to go look that up.
No, it's ridiculous. It's 200,000 miles long.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, we may end up talking about ice on a little bit too later. According to them, they came here, they were looking for monoatomic and gold in mass to ionize and put in their atmosphere, which is a wonderful radiation shield. So that's what their story was. So about 5,000 years later, 445,000 years ago, Anu, who was their king, and I put a genealogy table for him in the prehistory in Nibiru in my book, And I also posted an entire genealogy table for the Anunnaki on my Facebook page, Gerald-Clark. So anybody wants to go and get it, I put it in the back of the book. Said, people, if you want this and you're a serious seeker, I'll send it to you. And it turned out there were so many people doing it, I just posted it. So everybody that's listening, it's up on my Facebook page. So my entire genealogy table is up there. Anyway, so Anu was their king. He sent his son, Enki, to Earth to get gold. He was the premier scientist, and he was his firstborn son. Anu was married to Antu. That was his wife. So Enki's the firstborn son. His planet was Neptune, and another name for him in the Enuma Elish, or the Epic of Creation, was Ea Enki, or Nutamud. So he had several names, and they all did. They had an AKA list. Each one of them did. So keeping that in mind helps you track them cross-culturally, because they lived a long time. So he comes here, lands in the Persian Gulf, sets up the city of Eridu with about 50 Igigi workers that came with him. That's what they called them. They started to get gold from the ocean. They weren't getting it fast enough, according to the account. They were then using spectroscopy, probably, and telemetry. They found more significant amounts of gold in South Africa, which they moved their operations there, and this is what was said in the documents. Began mining ore for many shars. A shar was 3,600 years. And then if you read the Atrahasis account, which I put into my book, this was by Oxford University Press, where they did the tabloid translation. They were there for many shars. And after a very long time, they revolted. At that point, Enki and his half-sister, whose name was Ninhartsog, she was the medical officer. Her headquarters was in the city of Shurupak, where Noah was the king of Shurupak, if you read the Bible. Okay. So it's no coincidence that city comes up. Anyway, so they were tasked to take the Neanderthals that Enki had found on the plains of Africa, jumpstart them to a place where they could be used as a primitive worker to replace the revolting miners in South Africa, which they did, and they didn't get it right the first time, and there were many iterations they described in the documents to produce us, which they did. The first lot of us they produced could not procreate. They were studying us to make sure that we were the right fit and function for this mining task. And by the way, the entire Anunnaki Council was composed of 12 people. Enki was on the council. His rank was 40. Anu was on the council. His rank was 60. And Antu was on the council as well, so it was six women and six men. So Anu, 60, and there was a sexagesimal number system. That's why they chose the ranks they did. That's base 60. 55 with Antu, and then the next one down, and this is as of 3760 BCE, this council composition. And the next one down was Enlil, and his rank was 50. And his wife was Ninlil, and her rank was 45. The next one down was Enki, and his rank was 40. And I put this entire table in the back, table 9 in my book.
And without losing your train of thought there, what is the reasoning behind these numbers, this number system?
Yeah, well, actually, it was interesting. They chose a sexagesimal system. I think it's because based on whatever reason on their planet, and it had to do, I think, with their orbit around the sun, because it was all by tens and 10 times 6, and then that was the minimum number, and then it would go up from there. And it ended up that 3,600 was the period of the orbit of their planet around the sun, according to their records. So I think that's probably the basis of where the sexagesimal number system came from.
Okay.
Yeah. So so they're here. They did the genetic experiments. They produced a non-breeding worker to meet the labor requirements. They weren't meeting the labor requirements fast enough, and at that point, this is where the important character of Thoth Ningxia comes in. He was Enki's scientific son that carried the caduceus, modified the DNA so that they could procreate. They were taken from Africa, the House of Shimti, where they were in South Africa, near the gold mines, back up to the Eden in Mesopotamia, in the city of Eridu, the very first city on this planet. In that garden, they were being watched by Enki and Enlil, these two high-level Anunnaki council members. One of them was their creator. The other one was he was a commander, I guess. Let's talk about Enlil just real quick.
I'll tell you what. We're so close to our break. Let's just do a quick recap when we come back and bring us right back into the two overlords, as it were. Okay? Let's do that, because I don't want to have to stop you mid-thought. All right, we'll be right back with our guest tonight, Gerald Clark. Well, I don't know about you, but my brain is spinning. And after this much time on planet Earth, that's actually saying something. Lots of questions, perhaps some calls later on. We're just going to let Gerald Clark just roll with it and see if the next time we have a photograph taken of ourselves by someone, our heads are abnormally large. This is Coast to Coast AM. Yes, indeed, a little spirit for you. I wondered what song what program that song would be appropriate for. And there you go, from the 12 Dreams of Dr. Sardonicus. From back in the days when dinosaurs roamed the earth. Not really. Feels like it, though. All right, we'll be right back with Gerald Clark in just a moment. Please check out his book as soon as you can. It is kind of a long title, The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators, Enslavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. We'll get to all of that, but we're in the history lesson part right now, so get another proper cup of tea and get it ready to go, because we'll be right back with Mr. Clark in just a moment on the Saturday night edition of Coast to Coast AM. Hang on. All right, Mr. Clark. Now take us back just a little bit. We have the slaves which could not procreate, and yes, so sir. And then take us back to the 12 and the just okay. Bring us back where we were. I'm just an audience member tonight. I'm just listening to you. You know what I mean? So just roll with it.
No worries. So we were in Eridu, and we had a couple of high level council members there to do some watching to see if these two primitive workers they brought out of Africa could procreate. So that was Enki and Enlil. So now go back to Genesis and read this part again about the Garden of Eden, knowing the Sumerian account. It makes it quite interesting, okay? And who got smeared and what happened. And I want to really illuminate this. George liked the story, so I'm going to tell it good for you, right? So Enlil and Enki are in the garden. Ningxida, Enki's second-born son, who was Thoth, Hermes, and multiple other incarnations, the carrier of the Caduceus, which I want to link into the Starfire Gold, okay? They're there monitoring these two beings that they've created, see if they could produce a baby. Well, in that account, it's interesting, Enki had a very sophisticated medicinal garden, and they're at the Garden of Eridu, according to the accounts. And in that garden were probably plants that his half-brother didn't want them to have. Now, you have to understand that at this point in time, they're both okay with the idea of producing, jump-starting these Neanderthals into primitive workers. Enlil's on board. He approved it on the council. He was the highest-ranking member on the council on Earth, because Anu, the next highest-ranking male, was back on Nibiru. They drew lots, and they split up. So Enlil really ended up with all of Mesopotamia, and Enki ended up with all of Africa. So that kind of lands those two beings in those two different places to kind of keep track of this name soup. Does that help?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so now we're back in the garden. They're watching for babies to be born. And at this point, this is the famous account where they were tempted with some plant in the garden of knowledge of good and evil. Well, if you go back and read the account again, and I'll tell you who it was, though. The one who was monotheistized as God was Enlil, okay, in the Old Testament. So he comes along and says, if you eat any plant, you'll surely die, right? Well, they ate the plant, and they didn't die. They actually woke up and became sentient beings, just like Enki, the evil snake, told them they would. So Enlil lied to them, told them, you eat this plant, you're going to die. And Enki told them, no, you won't die. You'll become aware and start differentiating between good and evil like we do. So Enki told the truth. It was demonized as a snake. Well, Enlil, who was monotheistized by the Hebrews while they were held captive in Babylon, and saw the Sumerian documents for the first time, created the Torah account, and basically cut him out of it. So Enki and Ninhartzog, his half-sister, were the true creators of mankind in the Atrahasis account. Okay, and I put the original of that account in my book. So,
that's amazing stuff, man. Keep going, please.
Yeah, it's pretty hardcore. Okay, so Ningxida, who was Thoth, Enki's son, was truly a scientist just like his father. And a geneticist. He was premier. I mean, these beings from Nibiru, apparently their IQs were quite high. We're talking 1200 range.
Was that all?
Yeah, that's that all? Exactly. So we pale in comparison. Anyway, so they specifically created us to meet a primitive worker function. They didn't give us all their capabilities. So the reality is we're a chimera ourselves. We're a mixture of the creator of all's DNA, however it evolved into Neanderthal man. Maybe genetic interventions by alien species many times prior to that. Who knows? Okay? But from that point that we have in the Sumerians, they modified the Neanderthal, put their mark on it. So we're partly Neanderthal and partly Anunnaki. All of us are. So, and that's evidenced probably by the fact that the majority of our DNA, they call it junk DNA, according to science, 95% of it's inactivated. Well, listen, nature doesn't do that. Nature doesn't produce junk in DNA in any other species. So that's ridiculous. And I'm sure quite certain that since we've been focused on the Mesopotamian region since the turn of the century, at least back since the 1890s with Major Henry Rollins and Henry Laird, I'm quite sure they've probably pulled out one of these graves and done a DNA analysis to see, well, this is what the DNA of the pure Niburians were, and this is what ours is like when it gets mixed with a primitive worker. So we probably have known that for, I don't know, 70 years, 67 years, if I had to guess. So the idea that these creators are gone and not influencing our lives and all the misinformation is a bunch of nonsense. They've been here since the very beginning. They've never left, some of them, and they've been the power structure behind every government and every one who wielded power since the inception of time relative to man.
Well, certainly a very strong case can be made for this, and you're saying they're still in control, always have been.
Well, let's talk about their lifespans, okay? If you go back to the Sumerian kings list, which Berossus was a historian in Babylon, and he wrote this history of the Sumerians for the Greeks in around 330 BC, about the same time the Hebrews were being held captive there, coincidentally. Anyway, in that account, he laid out who the first king was on this planet, all the way up to the ninth one on this planet. That occupied 241,000 years, and the very first one he named was Elulim, who landed in the city of Eridu, the very city that Enki said he built when he landed here. So there's some corroborating evidence for you right there. So how did the very first one rule, according to the Sumerian records that Berossus wrote? And this is in the Library of Congress where I first saw this and got it firsthand myself because I just didn't believe it. He said he ruled for 28,800 years by himself. Now, how is that possible? And that pales in, I mean, the ages of Melchizedek and Lamech and so on and forth, they pale in comparison to what we're talking about in the Sumerian kings list. Many, many of them ruled for 28,000 years or more, and they were all in increments of shars, which was a 3,600-year period that their planet orbited the sun. So that in and of itself is amazing. And their ninth ruler that ended at 241,000 years on this earth, that account ended at what they called the Great Deluge. So now all of a sudden you've got an account in the Sumerian record that correlates with, you know, this flood of Noah, who, by the way, was a son of Enki, according to their records. His name was Atrahasis Zeasudra, or to us he was known as Noah. So that's really quite interesting. And I'll jump to that in a second, but I kind of want to go back to this Caduceus energy body connection with Ningxia and Starfire Gold, because they were somehow facing a real problem on this planet. And there was an account where the medical officer, Nin Hartzog, was visited by an emissary from Nibiru who landed here, and they shuttled back and forth, supplies going back and forth, and so on and so forth. And he recognized her, and he goes, you know, we were in school together, you and I. And she looked at him, and he looked, 40 years younger than her. And he goes, you have noticeably aged. And she started getting a clue that the quick orbital cycles on this planet, how long they'd been here mining gold, was affecting their aging. And they didn't, and they took a proactive stance on this. They didn't do it passively. So she was seminal in coming up with solutions to whatever this radiation close to the sun, whatever it was that was causing them to age. And they found a solution for it, a couple of them. One of them goes way back to the Crusarians, where they were drinking the flow of the Babylonian birth goddesses, and some hormone in there was affecting their pineal gland, and that's where it started. So the red flower and all this stuff with the chalice and the Heros Gatnos ceremony had to do with taking in various substances to try to affect consciousness and prolong life. And speaking of that, so they were, it looked like the Anunnaki were doing both. So then this is where the gold connection kind of comes in. So, and hopefully I'm not jumping around too much.
No, it's all right. You're a little tough to track with, but I'm trying here.
Okay, so keep in mind the human electrical body that we started out talking with.
Yeah.
Okay? And the chakras and the idea of this symbol that Enki's son was carrying, and I'm going to connect that into the Starfire gold for you. So that symbol, let's talk about it just real quick so we can relate that to the energy body. We've got a central pole. We've got two snakes entwined around it, leading upwards. Their tails are at the bottom. Their heads are facing each other toward the top. There's a little knob on top of the central pole, and then there are wings that come out both sides. That was the symbol. And you see this in chiropractor offices and medical offices here in the United States and in Britain.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's called the Caduceus, and that goes all the way back to this creation account with Ningxida, because he was a geneticist, and the entwined serpents represented the double helix of DNA. So people that were scientists and dealt with DNA, they had that symbol, and that was his. So anyway, so what does it mean? Basically, in our construction as electrical bodies, as modems, really, our interface, the electromagnetic spectrum, is specified by the symbolism of the caduceus. So at the very bottom of that pole, at the bottom of our tailbone, is what's called the ganglion of Impar. And that's the most negative pole of our energy body. When you image it, whatever method you want to use, and there's lots of them out there, you can research them. So at that place, it shows two snake tails coming together and then emanating upwards. Well, this is representative in the yogic tradition of the release of what's called kundalini energy. So somehow they're referring to some latent energy that could be stored in a human sacrum, which is really a bizarre shape if you look at it in and of itself.
Oh, yeah.
And then the entwined serpents going up, if you count the number of places where the serpents cross, it turns out there's seven nodes. Okay, that's representative of the seven chakras of your human body. So the DNA emanating from as an entwined serpent going up the central pole represents the energy flowing up this pole through your chakras once it's released, and we can talk about how it's supposedly released. But this process of this energy fully occupying the quantized seven chakras of a human is the process of waking up to the highest place of energy. And this is an equation that I developed in my book. Is I came up with an equation to show you what that number is so you can measure it. Okay, so you want to know what your energy is? Well, we can measure it now. And you can determine the extent to which it's optimized for you just using simple math. Okay, so that being said, somehow the Anunnaki were focused on what's called the pineal gland. This is a single unary gland at the top of your head, which Rene Descartes believed was the source of your thoughts and your intelligence. Because everything else is bicameral in your brain. This is kind of unique, and he was looking for a place like this. Anyway, in the yogic tradition, it's affiliated with the seventh chakra, okay? The crown chakra.
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean? Well, in the energy body system that we're talking about, and you can image this with our system, is it people that attempt to relate themselves to the gravity field, like people that do yoga and such like that, their body limbers up and blockages are removed such that their energy is higher than people that don't. And this can be measured.
Okay, so this is a real thing. This is not woo-woo.
And as a matter of fact, I've got a really neat system. I spent over $6,000 on it from a guy named Dr. Harry Oldfield, who pioneered what's called polychromatic interference photography. And in a nutshell, it captures a chroma deviation as photons interact with the weak bioelectric field of a human, which you can measure with a frequency meter. It saves you from going and making measurements all up and down the spine and converting that into wavelength so you can see it. And it does it in video so you can see it real time. Anyway, so I've been using that system for over 12 years, and I'm one of the few licensed investigators in the United States that use that technology. And I was doing it with clients as experiments, so I need to publish that data too pretty soon. But I learned some pretty profound things about human energy and structure and the way that people comport their lives and their activities. So people that are doing yoga and stretching and watching what they're eating and things, it really has an impact on their energy, and you can see this.
Okay.
Okay,
listen, you just keep going. This is absolutely fascinating. I mean, I've got a bunch of questions, but I'm just going to keep them to myself for a while.
Okay, so imagine. imagine this energy is flowing up like this Caduceus says it does around these intertwined serpents, changing the DNA is what that's indicative of, okay? Mm-hmm. Which it does somehow, some way. And this is really a deep topic that Enki seemed to design into us as a way for us to wake up our consciousness. He didn't want us to just be slaves. And this gets really interesting, okay? So, as this energy is traveling up, it really reaches the top of the pineal gland, which Rene Descartes was really focused on. And at that point, something happens where energy releases the pineal gland to actually wake up and start pumping cerebral spinal fluid into the lateral ventricles. That's what the wings coming out the side represent. So when that starts happening to your brain, it starts operating left and right together, and you become much more capable mentally, I guess you could say, and it's part of reaching higher consciousness. And the people that do yoga for 20 years, that's what they're after, is getting that seventh chakra to work so that they're getting the wings of Hermes, essentially.
Okay.
So, yeah, you with me? So
yeah, yeah,
that's
totally.
That's pretty interesting ancient knowledge about energy and matter that isn't talked about at all when you go to the chiropractor, anybody that has that symbol today.
Well, I was about to ask you, what could the effect be on civilization if this stuff was taught generally?
Well, it was taught generally along the Nile in Egypt, along the 12 mystery schools that Thoth set up to do in the first place. So the whole thread of what will happen in the Garden of Eden about the suppression of consciousness is still going on today. Enlil didn't want humans to have higher consciousness. He wanted them to be primitive workers, period. And if you go back to the Atrahasis account, he brought multiple onslaughts of incursions to wipe out humans because he didn't want them challenging his authority if they grew.
And one more time, I don't mean to be a moron here, but and one more time, who is he?
He was the one at rank 50. He was the commander who controlled all of Mesopotamia.
Gotcha. Okay.
So as of 3760 BC, everything that went on in the Levantine, in Samaria, upwards near Persia and Syria was all under Enlil's command, okay? And listen, he had a reputation that was very severe. He was the god of wrath and vengeance that was talked about. And so people try to placate, these people were really evil. That's why he told them all to kill each other with a sword. Well, when you really find out who Enlil was, he was a great destroyer, straight up. I mean, this guy was a genocidal murderer toward the humans. And if it weren't for Enki, there wouldn't be one of us left on this planet. Not one. So he brought after 600 years of the primitive worker program in Africa, some of them got brought up to Mesopotamia where Enlil was. Okay? He decided they were too noisy. He called a council meeting and said, that's it. I want them eliminated. I want them gone. I can't get any sleep. This is exactly what he said. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how about some earplugs, buddy? They're busting their butts, mining gold for you down in the mines day and night, and you're complaining about them making noise and you can't sleep? Wow. Well, what does he do next? He brings Sarupu disease, whatever that was, Asaku disease, whatever that was. Apparently, one of them was so severe it didn't allow a woman to have a baby. It tightened her uterus up, so it was just, womb death. It was unbelievably destructive. Cut off the food supply, cut off the water, starved them. So after 6 years of this, they were eating each other. It was disgusting what he did.
I'll tell you what, we have to take a top of the hour break, but when we come back, let's rewind about a minute and a half and then take it from there and go forward and figure out if some of these great dispensations occurred by the Great One, whoever was the creator of the Anunnaki themselves, and just decided the DNA is too corrupted, we just need to go ahead and erase and start over. I mean, if that even applies to this, I'm not really even sure at this point. Interesting, don't you find? We'll be right back with Gerald Clark on Coast to Coast AM. Stand by.